Hello and welcome to the Innovation Agency podcast with me, Caroline Kenyon. In this episode, we're turning back the clock by 1 year to the start of the coronavirus pandemic when we were all so oblivious to the full impact of what was about to be unleashed. We're going to hear from four individuals who were at the centre of the biggest story in the country at the time, setting up the UK's first quarantine unit for about 50 years. They work for three of the key organisations involved in the unit: Wirral University Teaching Hospital, Wirral Primary Care Network and Public Health England. So it's now a full year since the call came through to Wirral University Teaching Hospital asking for a quarantine unit to be set up for around 90 people who were arriving in the UK from Wuhan. That was on 31st of January 2020. And within 48 hours, a residential block on the Arrow Park Hospital site was emptied, and the staff and families living there were found other accommodation. It was a huge operation. And here to tell us how they did it are the Medical Director of Wirral University Teaching Hospital, Dr. Nikki Stevenson, GP Dr. James Perry of Primary Care Wirral, Wirral University Teaching Hospital Head of Strategic Planning, Mike Gibbs, and Public Health Senior Registrar, Wendy Shepherd. So everybody, can you believe it? A full year's gone by and we're still in the thick of it. It's amazing, isn't it? What would you have said if someone had been able to predict to you this time last year what was going to be happening in the past year?
I don't think I could have called it personally. I think we thought this was just something that we were going to be involved with for a few weeks, you know, a month tops, and then everything would be back to normal. And then here we find ourselves, you know, a year later, as you say.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it, James, really? It's to think over how quick the year has actually gone from a quarantine facility to full number of lockdowns to coming back as a sort of 1 year anniversary of where this all started in the UK. It's incredible. Completely agree, we'd never be able to predict that.
We've just gone from lockdown to lockdown and we still haven't all met for that drink to celebrate the unit closing.
Nikki, if we cast our minds back to everything that happened a year ago, can you recall for us how you felt when that call came through and what was going through your mind when you were first told what was going to be happening?
Yeah, so we got a call from the national team asking us if we would be prepared to house some repatriated guests from Wuhan and that they'd been exposed to coronavirus. And of course, at that point, we knew nothing about the virus, what impact that might have. But we were told, that it was potentially highly significant and might cause problems. So we had to make sure that we set up that quarantine facility really thoroughly. The staff who lived there, because as you said, it was an accommodation block, were absolutely fantastic. You know, this was the homes of some people and had been for years. And they agreed to move out to accommodate the arriving guests. And then it was all hands on deck. So working out what sort of people we might expect, because we didn't know that at the time. We weren't sure of exact numbers. We were thinking about the clinical pathways. We were trying to make the staff accommodation into four-star hotel equivalent. Then trying to work out how they were going to arrive, because they came in at Bryars Norton. How would we sort out food and the logistics and that side of things? Obviously, as in the NHS, we don't usually work with big logistical problems. But what I would say is that we had, you know, really good support from partners across the system and the UK to help us do that. Everybody on the call today, you know, is based on Wirral, but we did have support from the national teams. And direction from the national teams as to what to expect. But that first flurry of activity was pretty full on. I mean, we were in the accommodation till the wee small hours of the morning, trying to make sure that it was fit for purpose and, welcoming them when they eventually arrived, tired and relieved to be back in the UK.
Yeah, I think listening to Nikki there, even at the beginning when you were saying, you know, we've been told about coronavirus, it's just almost impossible to imagine. It wasn't even called COVID-19 at that point, was it? We had no insight into what this was, how potentially lethal it was, you know, the effect it might have on guests, their exposure, how it might affect them, how it might affect us. There were so many unknowns, and it's almost impossible to place yourself back in that position now when it's front page press every day for the last 365 days, really. It's almost hard for me to take myself back to that kind of moment. I think I remember turning up, and Wendy had been on the ground a little bit before me and Mike, certainly. And in terms of the logistical running of it, had taken on kind of a bit of a lead role from that on the ground as well. And I don't know how you look back and think of it, Wendy.
I suppose for me, I mean, I just can't believe that 51 weeks ago, almost exactly, isn't it, that we hadn't seen any cases of COVID within the country. Like you say, it wasn't even called COVID-19. I remember that being announced during the second cohort at Arrow Park, by the time we actually got a recognised disease name for it. But, you know, the anxiety around the fact that this was an unknown, that it was classed as a high consequence infectious disease, a HCID, so one of the real nasties from an infectious disease point of view. I remember James being hazmated up to the nines, you know, when we were taking the first swabs in the country at that time, because we had no idea what we were dealing with, and it was obviously better to be safe than sorry, really.
No, I've never asked you this before, Wendy. Did you ever feel anxious about, you knew more about infectious disease than probably the rest of us, I'd say, based on your training and stuff. Did you ever feel anxious about the potential consequence? Because I remember thinking, I just got a call, and at one point the GP and clinical team were going to be remote, and that got changed, and then we were in-house and basically living at the unit. And I was certainly a bit anxious because it was this unknown disease. And were you ever like that?
I think not to the same degree, potentially. I mean, obviously, you know, we worked closely, and, you know, we obviously had dedicated infection control leads there as well, you know, in terms of making sure that the safe centre was safe as if it was a high consequence infectious disease. I think I would have been more anxious if we'd had a positive test come through, because then, you know, you've got a positive and you really don't know what you're dealing with and what this looks like in terms of clinical presentation, infectivity and all of those kind of type of things. But no, I think we had all the correct control measures in place from the get-go, and yeah, I wasn't anxious in that sense. No, I mean, obviously you guys may have been.
There were anxieties among the hospital staff that you had to deal with. How what was that like? What were people saying to you, and how worried were they, and how did you reassure them?
Yeah, so our staff and our local community initially were really concerned because of all the unknowns that we've discussed. There was a lot of debate about why Wirral was chosen and whether that was a punishment in some sort of way, because obviously it was quite distant from where the guests actually landed down at Bryce Norton. From what we were told, it was simply because we'd had a visit from NHS England previously, and they'd identified that we had this accommodation block, which was right next to the hospital. So in many ways, that made a lot of sense, because, again, we didn't know how much medical import that they would require. And as it turned out, none of them needed to come into hospital. We did get some services out to the guests from secondary care.
I was going to say, it was all the medical input they needed was really non-COVID related, wasn't it?
It was. So yeah, our staff were really worried. And again, it's incredible to believe now, but we held daily briefings in our lecture theatre that probably houses 150 people. There were probably 200 people in there because they were so worried. And, you know, you can't believe that we allowed all those people in the room at that time. But such was the concern that myself and the chief executive and the other executives did daily briefings with the staff. And what was interesting was that the change. So right at the beginning, all the concerns were around the guests and what risks that they might pose. And then, of course, then we had the second lot of guests from the Diamond Princess. And then COVID was starting to be talked about in the UK. So the questions at those daily briefings really changed from the focus being on what about the guests? And then latterly, it was all, what does coronavirus mean now that it's here? How will it affect us? So it was really interesting to see that transition in the line of questioning. And I think the other thing that was absolutely fabulous of the people of Wirral, although they were worried and concerned, they absolutely welcomed those people. Yeah. So the local school kids, they did pictures and drawings and welcome pictures for the guests, and people sent in, you know, gifts to the sort of receiving hub, which was off-site, so to try and minimise traffic. And actually, they were really warm-hearted and welcoming. I think you felt that as well, didn't you, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was really humbling to see the local response, and yeah, the gifts and the charity donations, the kids' toys, the puzzles, the games that that locals gave. It was incredible. We had two full rooms with all sorts. So there was plenty of entertainment for the guests and for their children as well.
I think that's the point, Caroline, to appreciate that we didn't know who was coming until they arrived. So we had to cater for all ages. So we knew that there might be some children. We knew that there might be guests with coexisting health problems and trying to make sure that we had all the medication. What we hadn't quite realised until she arrived was that one of our guests was heavily pregnant and due to give birth. And that causes a little bit of anxiety, is probably too strong a word, but we planned very carefully about what would happen if she went into labour while she was in the facility. And I'm glad to say that she didn't.
I think that just raises that point, doesn't it? That everything that we did was kind of a first, and there was no operational plans for anything when we got there, and we very quickly kind of ran into some issues firsthand and then started to think about issues secondhand as we really started to bed in and everything we were doing. As you said at the beginning of this, the last time there was a quarantine unit was kind of back in the 70s for smallpox, so we had nothing to refer to. And I remember getting there to start with, as we kind of just touched on before, it was Wendy doing the public health and the logistics, and then I think probably from a Worth perspective and from every other perspective, we realised we quickly needed to look at the logistics of this because this was becoming massive. And that's when you came in, wasn't it, Mike?
You were a bit late to the party, I think, Mike, weren't you?
Yes, well, I was enjoying myself. I was on holiday in Centre Parks, actually, at the time. So whilst all of these stellar efforts were going on with hardly any time, I was getting some needed R&R. But first heard about it, it was my dad, actually, who said he saw on some mainstream media around Arrow Park campus being selected to host these UK nationals being repatriated from Wuhan. So it wasn't until I actually got back home and started looking through some work emails that I all the comms had gone out, and in fact we were going to host these guests, so I was really anxious to get back because I knew that I could offer some help. So I remember going back in on the sort of Monday morning, 8 o'clock, got in contact with the chief exec, and by about 9:30 I was in the quarantine facility, and I was there for another 3 weeks. So I did a full 21 days, and I think, like, overall, you know, just such a humbling experience. I think as soon as I first arrived, I think that arrival was so frenetic. I remember seeing Wendy, who was relieved. It was, thank goodness that you're here. Here's a manifest of the staff.
I think I was just exhausted by that point, Mike. I was so relieved to see you.
As the guys have said, it was the unknown, it was that uncertainty. There was so many stakeholders and different organisations who were present, who were offering support. So it was trying to really unpick who was doing what and whose role was what. So another sort of priority for me was to try and set up a hub, some sort of command centre inside the facility, and try and organise some of those rooms. So as I mentioned, there was rooms with gifts that had been donated, but there was rooms full of electronic equipment, there was non-perishable food, there was clothes, sanitary products, it was all sorts of things. So it was trying to get an understanding of all the different equipment and the different items that we had, but actually having a central point where everyone could get together and we could actually roll out and lay who's working in what team and the tasks for the day. And it was really, I think it was really useful. And hopefully the team found it really beneficial. And I think there were tactical command meetings first thing every morning. So it was really good to get an update from them, have a briefing and then actually lay out, this is what the plans are for the day. So it was a really good opportunity for the team to highlight concerns. But yeah, an incredibly humbling experience.
You had a lot to do that you hadn't ever prepared for, didn't you? I mean, what was going through your minds, all of you, when you were confronted with this situation with no sort of template of how to react and how to put the right procedures in place. How did you stay calm and focus on the priorities and decide who was doing what and what you're going to do next? How did you go about all that? It sounds like a logistical challenge, to say the least.
There's sort of two functions, because James, Wendy and Mike were inside the isolation facility. And of course, one of the things we did was minimise the number of people going in and out because it was thought to be a high consequence infectious disease. But outside of that, there were lots of meetings and command structures going on and then feeding into the teams inside. So at the start of it, there were lots of meetings, some chaired by the national teams, some by the regional teams. Then there was this tactical team that Mike talked about that met at least daily and initially twice daily. That included people from health, from the police, fire, local authority. You know, there's a whole swathe of people in there trying to work out what the priorities were and then feeding into the groups with expertise. So in amongst that structure that was happening outside the isolation facilities, there was a clinical group and all sorts of groups so that each could focus on their area of expertise. So then we were able to draw up guidance and then get that live feedback for, actually, this is not working from the guys inside the isolation facilities, or actually we need help with this because this is what the reality of it is. So there was a whole team, both inside and outside. And then, of course, with the national interests, the very highest echelons of the NHS, that they were intimately overseeing what was happening because this was such a new experience for everybody.
Wasn't there a photo in Simon Stevens' Twitter feed of the window in the accommodation block with a thank you message on? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think NHS England shared that out, and I think it got several thousand likes and retweets. So, yeah, it was really powerful, real powerful message that one of the guests left for us.
Were you aware on the inside of the amount of attention that it was getting from the media, from the public, from the government, the politicians? Were you conscious of that at the time?
We obviously weren't sort of fully resident there, so we were going in and out of the facility and going home at night and seeing our families and things along those sort of lines. So whilst it was quite all encompassing, we did have an awareness of what was going on outside. You couldn't walk from the car park to the building without walking past camera crews and things along those sort of lines. So you knew what was going on outside. There was obviously sort of keen interest here. I mean, I remember one of the key things was, and I'm sure everyone remembers this, is the photo of the buses as they were coming in, the clinical staff there in the hazmat suit. You got the driver there just, you know, absolutely totally, yeah. You know, and it's that kind of thing, you know, about actually it's just the mixed messages that are going on from that. And, you know, so you were very conscious those kind of discussions were there and being talked about in the background, really. You couldn't avoid it.
But it was quite strange, wasn't it? Because it was definitely the two sides to the coin, where you'd see all of that on the TV and then you'd be in the unit and there was two clinic, you know, GPs doing it and some nurses. And I'd feel when you were in there that we were really part of their community, and everyone in there, all the guests were well from a COVID perspective. And I remember at the beginning, kind of the feeling inside matching the feeling on the outside. And I remember we used to sleep there at night and been like an F1 with my phone there waiting for it to go off and, you know, run off and do CPR or something crazy and not being able to sleep on the first night and setting about 12 alarms on my phone to get up in the morning and stuff. And then as time went on and they gained more of a sense of community, we built quite a lot of rapport with the guests, really, didn't we? We were on first name terms and, you know, some cases more than others where we'd had a bit more input to their routine care and wants and needs. It just felt like a home from home in a way. And I look back at it quite fondly, really. But I remember at the beginning, the euphoria on the outside definitely kind of matched the inside. And then as we developed our own SOPs, and as Nikki alluded to, the preparedness was there in the background, and no one got ill and we were getting closer towards the, you know, the end of the 14 days, it all became a little more calm inside. And the main focus turned into the everyday life things like when's the shopping coming, when's the food being served, and then Mike's specialities kicked in and he sorted all that stuff out.
And you mentioned SOPs, standing operating procedures. So you're producing SOPs for all the different things that you were important to predict and plan for. Was there anything you missed? Was there anything that took you by surprise, or did you actually end up preparing for all eventualities?
I don't think you could possibly prepare for all eventualities, to be honest with you. There was no playbook for this. This was the first isolation facility for infectious diseases of this nature, sort of in 40 years. And we were really lucky because, you know, we had such a great team of staff within that building who all were very, very happy to sort of be all hands on deck and work across professional boundaries and things along those sort of lines. So one of PHE's roles was we produced what we called a resource pack, which basically was all the infection control processes, the guide, some of the processes and policies that were sort of followed operationally within the facility. And that was a constant iteration and changing that based on everything that we found out each day as you get to know your guests, as you get new scenarios. I think by the time we left, we were probably on version sort of 70 of that. And that, I'm genuinely not joking about that. So, for instance, we had somebody who we'd looked at clinical pathways and things, as Nikki's already talked about. One of the first things we came across was somebody who needed urgent dental care. And that was something that you kind of think, well, if we have somebody who needs CPR, if somebody needs surgery, if somebody, you know, becomes symptomatic with COVID, all of these things, you kind of sort of think, okay, well, you know, we know vaguely what we're doing that. And then out of the sort of left field, you get dentistry, you know, which is, and like James said, you know, sort of pregnancy and things along those sort of lines. You absolutely could not plan for every eventuality, no matter how hard you tried, I don't think.
In terms of covering all eventualities, our clinical pathways, we had, of course, there's going to be a few exceptions, but we had thought of what happened if they needed surgery, what happened if they needed to go to another hospital. We linked in with our specialist trust to say, if they have a heart attack and they need to come to you for, you know, intervention, what we're going to do. And we linked in with the specialist maternity unit for dealing with people with high consequence infectious diseases, which is up in the northeast, and helped devise a pathway for the pregnant woman. And actually, that stood us in really good stead for two reasons. One, when the Milton Keynes facility opened with them, I got in touch with the medical director then to say, don't start from scratch. Here's all our standard operating procedures. If there are any help, have them, because that will be some help. And then secondly, when COVID arrived in the UK and we were having to deal with those scenarios, we already had a really good baseline from the stuff that had been developed. So initially, we were ahead of the curve in dealing with COVID here because of that. So I think it was also interesting about the rumours. Apparently there was a tunnel running from the isolation facility to where we were burying patients in and out at the dead of night. But that obviously was not true.
I think we were very highly supported, weren't we? And I agree with all the points that have been made that we couldn't go, you know, cover every eventuality, but we did have a specialty team kind of linked in, me as the first point of contact on the ground to be able to go and call. So for instance, the dental thing, but we very quickly realized where that pathway would kick in, but everything wasn't a new scenario. And I remember being involved with writing all those SOPs for a pregnant guest, and she had about seven different outcomes of where she could have gone to and what might have happened, and unfortunately everything was fine in the end. But we had a lot of support from the infectious disease team over in Liverpool, and Mike Beardsworth, one of the top doctors over there. I was ringing him in the middle of the night about things that now you'd just say, oh, that's just a, you know, bit of gastroenteritis, leave it be. But at the time, we didn't know how COVID was going to present. So we had lots of resources to link in with, both public health, all the people on the ground as well, they haven't even mentioned yet. You know, we had a massive nursing team, we had a massive health and social team there, we had a mental health team on site, you know, all these people who were very proactive in trying to prevent these issues coming to the forefront to start with. I remember there was the mental health wellbeing checks that happened every day for the guests, just to check that they were getting on okay and that they didn't have any worries. And you know, a lot of these people, their first language wasn't English. They were in flats with people they'd never met before and weren't being allowed to mix the way they were used to. They were using technology that, you know, we use WhatsApp. They used, what was it, Mike? I can't remember.
WeChat, I think so.
WeChat, yeah. And you know, luckily there were some leaders amongst the guests as well who kind of rallied and got them all sorted on different communication paths. And
yeah, because communication was a big problem, wasn't it? Because remember, we couldn't get phone signal, and you know, we're trying to put masks up, and then it was then trying to work out how you could communicate within the facility and outside, because that was a huge challenge initially, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, and ultimately, you've got people who are in their rooms. You know, you're asking people not to come out. You know, you're asking people to limit mingling and things, but you want to know that people are okay, but you haven't got Wi-Fi signal. People aren't on UK mobile signals and things along those sort of lines. So it was the sort of the practicalities of it were really quite challenging just from that sort of side, which is where the daily welfare checks kind of came from initially. It was around making sure that the guests had that one-on-one contact with somebody every day. They weren't just left in their room to their own devices. And it also worked as a two-way thing for us as staff to be able to, you know, have that reassurance that everyone was okay, that there wasn't someone clinically going off somewhere that we weren't aware of, and make sure that we were putting the right support in from a very early point. So, you know, if somebody sort of said, you know, actually I'm feeling a bit lonely, or I know I'd like to be able to chat to my family or what have you, we were able to sort of send the mental health team in to support and things along those sort of lines, which was a benefit in many ways, because you had that personal contact that you wouldn't necessarily have had if we'd just had a sort of a WhatsApp group or something along those sort of lines.
And what were the residents like with you? I mean, bearing in mind it was at the very start of the pandemic, so you were trying to ask them to keep distant and to, you know, prevent any possible infection spreading. What was it like trying to manage that at that stage of our pandemic?
They'd obviously all come from Wuhan, where this had been in circulation for a few weeks before. They were a few weeks ahead of us. They'd already been sort of in lockdown in their local areas, or as we would come to know, no lockdown. They were much more au fait and familiar with the disease than we were. So they were actually incredibly happy to comply with different restrictions and different infection measures that we had in place from the get-go. There were a couple of people who wanted to do things like whole quiz nights to entertain the residents, which you kind of think that's a great idea in theory, but in practice, unless you can, you know, sort of socially distance everybody by making them stand 2 meters apart, that's just physically not going to happen. But yeah, I think the guests were all absolutely lovely, really. Didn't have any issues at all that I was aware of.
I agree, Wendy, and I think I get what you're saying in terms of, yeah, the quiz nights and you could see that they wanted to interact with one another. And I know at meal times, we had set meal times and sort of small cohorts were coming down a bit earlier and a bit earlier to sort of meet up socially distanced, but it did become a point where obviously we had, you know, over 90 guests and we were serving food in the sort of foyer, so it became at one point a bit crowded, so then we had to think practically, well, how can we try and reduce the amount of guests in the foyer any one time. So then we sort of staggered meal times, and actually the guests were more than happy with that, which is ideal, but it's still give them opportunity to catch up with one another. And we had a courtyard at the back of the accommodation that was sectioned off, so it did allow guests to spend a bit of time outside, get a bit of fresh air, stretch their legs. So I don't want to say like jail time sort of courtyard, but I think that's how it felt for them. I think initially they were really sort of, they were so pleased and so grateful. And I think for them, they just became quite fatigued. After that week or so, it was really much sort of, when are we going? What needs to be done now until we can go? So it did shift slightly some of the moods, and that's quite understandable, being the fact that they've been stuck in their sort of living quarters for 2 weeks, and as the guys have said, had to sort of deal with lockdown in Wuhan. So I can understand how they got a bit fatigued.
A lot of them have been isolating for 2 weeks before they came to us, and then 2 weeks with us. So it was a huge challenge for them, and they were in that feeling that they were so near and yet so far. Their families were outside, they wanted to see them. So I think towards the end, people were getting a bit tired and did express some thoughts of wanting to leave. And of course, legally, that was difficult, because we weren't detaining them. We were trying to offer some degree of protection. And, you know, we had security staff, but that was mainly to stop people getting in, because there was such media interest, rather than to prevent people from leaving. And I think that's where the team inside really came to their fore, because I know that on numerous occasions, conversations were had often in the middle of the night. You're right, they were all a really nice bunch of people, and, you know, from our point of view, so pleased that they all left with a clean bill of health.
think they equally got bored after we did the last set of swabs, didn't we? Because they were all kind of like, I've had the swabs now. And that in itself was a crazy thing to go through. We were swabbing everyone and trying to work out how to do it. At that point, all the samples had to go to a military base. The logistics of that, I must admit, at that point, now swabbing is just a day-to-day event that happens. For most medics, they'll probably reflect back and say, the last time I did swabbing was in fifth year of med school. And so that was something that the team at the Royal really helped me with, you know, catch back up with where I should be up to, and then kind of coordinate this first mass swab in the country for some time, really. And then the guests just wanted to know the results and know that they could go, and that was all they wanted at one point. When's my swab back? When's my swab back?
That's all we wanted to know as well, to be fair. We just kind of, you know, when you did that first round of swabs, you've had to have that anxiety there about, oh God, for what if somebody does come back positive? I remember James sort of texting me at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning, I think it was, sort of saying, you know, we've actually got some results. And, you know, that was where we were all thinking about it.
Because it was really planned, and because we had those procedures in place, it was sort of a given that if someone did come back positive, it was a straightforward procedure of what we were going to do. And I'm just going back to, I thought it was incredible, the amount of procedures and policies that were put together in literally in a few days. And then we set up a portal where staff and as Nikki said, we shared with colleagues down south. And it was just, I couldn't believe it, to try and write a SOP in the NHS would normally take a ridiculous amount of time, but it was just done. It was just, it needed to be done, and it was just done.
So does that mean you're much quicker at producing them now, Mike, or have you gone back to the cycle of committee approval and so on?
I definitely prefer that way of working, going through, definitely. I mean, there's something about planning, isn't it? And it's in my job title now. But I think sometimes you can overplan for things. But I think what was clear here was we were really proactive and thought as much as possible, and just focusing on how do we get the basics right. And I think that was the key, to plan for getting the basics right, and rather over planning and overthinking.
But do you remember we kind of, again, it was so many variants. We were like, well, what happens if we get a positive swab and they're well? What was if we get a positive swab and they're unwell? So I remember at that point we actually built the isolation rooms upstairs, didn't we? We didn't have those to start with. And then we had a plan that, you know, how many could the Royal take? How many could Newcastle take? And we were kind of working out if they're unwell. And there was just so many unknowns. And again, obviously putting those pathways in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think now, if you're positive, you just stay at home unless you are, you know, really unwell. Whereas we're talking about how do these guys go to isolation facilities across the country, or the infectious disease, rather, facilities across the country. Whereas now it's just so normal, isn't it? You're positive, you just stay at home for 10 days until your symptoms fade. So it's crazy, isn't it, how times have changed.
And just a few days after the Wuhan guest departed, you were told to get ready for another influx, weren't you? 32 people returning from the Diamond Princess cruise liner, which was a very different situation. Wendy, why was that so different? What did you have to do to prepare for those guests?
Number one, we had a little bit more of a lead-in time. We obviously had the experience of the previous cohort as well. So, you know, we knew what had worked, and you know, we'd had the opportunity to reflect about things that we would do differently. The other thing that was very different was the environment that they'd come from initially, because they'd been on a cruise ship, they'd been sort of circulating air systems, they'd been in shared spaces and things along those sort of lines. So, and you know, that they had actually been positive cases on there. So we knew that it was a different sort of situation that they were going to be coming from. And because of the environment that they'd come from, we put more stringent measures in place the second time. So, you know, James made reference to people coming down for lunches and things that in the first cohort, the second cohort, everybody was, you know, had to keep to their room. They're only allowed outside time with their family, with their sort of their flat, their apartment sort of cohort, really, to try and prevent any further spread, because we knew that we were much more likely to have positive cases from that second cohort, really.
Clinically, we felt a bit more comfortable with COVID even then, because in the first cohort, we had clinical cover 24 hours a day, whereas with the Diamond Princess group, we had cover from the night. Cover was actually remote, and we'd come in if we needed to, because we'd learnt about how kind of the pattern from the first group, and just the fact that this was an isolation unit as opposed to the first unit, which was a quarantine unit.
It does sound as though that the setup that you created was ideal. Would you consider making that a permanent offer to the NHS of being a quarantine unit or an isolation unit for any future outbreaks?
I'm not sure that the setup was ideal, to be honest. I mean, for the second, well, you know, we split the courtyard, for example, didn't we? Yeah. And so there was a lot of realising what the problems were and putting in mitigations. And I think the thing that was ideal was about its location next to the hospital. At that time, I'm not sure that would necessarily be needed going forward, because you'd probably want it to be on a site that wasn't so busy. Because, of course, we were trying to run a hospital alongside the facility. But I think what I could say is that we made the situation that we had as ideal as it could be. And as you've heard, through lots and lots of people helping to do that. I think initially they did consider about whether that would be a solution for an isolation unit long term. But I don't think that's been considered now. I think they would probably think at looking at some sort of, you know, more isolated base if the need came for it.
I think the Diamond Princess guests that came, yeah, they were certainly fewer unknowns, and I think we had that sort of lived experience of what we went through. But as the sort of that accommodation block being the enabler, I think there was quite a stark difference in the way that it was operated and some of the control measures that the guys mentioned. So things like the sort of exits or the entry and exit for staff, we completely changed, because we didn't want staff walking through any areas that the guests may be at. So we sort of set up green and red zones, and green zones being sort of a safe zone for staff to work in, where they just had to wear sort of scrubs and sort of normal sort of civvy clothes, whereas any of the red zone areas, they had to wear full PPE, so the full FFP3 and the sort of full face mask and gown and so forth. And also, as the guys have said, the sort of limiting the amount of contact the guests were having. So one of the things that we had to try and do was set up phone lines in each of the rooms and set up a call centre sort of service where they could call down if they wanted something around sort of a concierge type, a hospitality type service, if they wanted to speak to a health professional, or even if they had any sort of maintenance. So we really wanted to keep them up in their rooms, in their living quarters as much as possible. And if they did want to come down to go outside, then to sort of call from that. And I can remember the sort of the evening before they arrived, and we thought sort of practically around, especially with the guests staying in the rooms, you know, how would we drop food off and let them know that we've actually dropped food off for them? We couldn't go inside just in case they were positive. So we ended up ordering something like 50 wireless doorbells, the local DIY store and other sort of DIY places, just to try and put them on as many rooms as possible, so that when food was being delivered, we could ring the doorbell and let them know. And we also had to give them sort of quite strict times of when they could leave their rubbish out, so that we had cleaners going across the different corridors at different times, just to really try and reduce the amount of contact our staff had with the guests.
Is this a good point for us to name check some of the many organisations, or try not to leave any out, who were involved in helping all of this? Nikki, you've named a few of them, but I know Wirral Community Health were involved, Cheshire and Wirral Partnership, Wirral GP Federation, Liverpool University Hospitals, infectious diseases specialists, as we've heard, and School of Tropical Medicine in Liverpool, police, the fire, the ambulance, and Sodexo, the concierge services for the catering. There were just so many people, and the local community. There were so many involved, weren't there, in supporting it?
Yeah, the local authority were a huge help, so don't want to miss them out. And obviously the community trust as well, and the Cheshire and Wirral Partnerships, who provided invaluable advice around mental health support, and, you know, were inside the building as well. And colleagues from, you know, wherever we reached out to ask for help, we got it. And I think that was the bit that we all felt. That's a camaraderie that you can see of colleagues working inside the building, but also what we felt outside. Those relationships just were really strengthened because of that, that we were all working together for one common purpose. And there was not a single person that we said we need help here that refused to help, or that weren't volunteering to come and help.
Yes.
I think, you know, that was the amazing thing. In terms of name check, I must give a huge shout out to the pharmacy team at the University Teaching Hospitals, because they made sure that all the guests had the medication when they arrived, and that they had their ongoing medication to whichever GP service that they were going to afterwards. So apologies if we've missed anyone out, but I think go on, Mike.
NHS Property Services, I think a big shout out to them because their maintenance team came in and there was a number of sort of maintenance issues, just a lot of the rooms hadn't been used from a staff accommodation point of view. So they had troops on the ground and they provided a 24-hour service, especially because of that uncertainty. And we had trouble with like delivery vehicles coming anywhere near the site. And we brought the team of maintenance guys in. So yeah, big shout out to NHS Property Services.
Mike, you've got something you want to read to us, haven't you?
We were left a message the day before the first cohort of guests departed. So I'll read it out. So please bear with me because it is a small writing, but here we go. Dear staff, I didn't want to leave without expressing my deepest gratitude for what you have done for us over these past 2 weeks. I arrived at a potential carrier of a deadly virus. I was a little anxious as to how I would be received. I needn't have been. You greeted us warmly with gifts, cards, flowers, and smiles. You made us feel welcome. In our time of a turmoil, you took care of us with compassion and professionalism. The experience has been humbling. Not once did I feel you didn't have enough time to speak to me or help me. You proactively sought to make me and my confinement here more comfortable. I am one of the 83, but I'm sure my sentiment is shared by all of us. Thank you.
Okay, that's absolutely brilliant. Thank you. Have things changed for any of you as a result of this experience? So it's a year ago. You've mentioned the SOPs that you're developing at high speed. I don't know if that process has changed at all, but has anything else changed, would you say, as a result of what happened there?
Go on, Mike, tell us about your promotion.
I just to let you know that I did actually apply for that job prior to and seeking work, and there was no connection with my promotion and my secondment. Thank you. Thanks, James. So what I'd say, Caroline, I definitely think there's been a renewed energy, a focus and commitment for partnership working. I think it's, as everyone has said, how everyone got together, teamwork, but from different organisations, complete different staff groups, different cultures, everyone's just got together. And I think what we really show was how good we all worked as a team and as partnership. And I think that's absolutely key for me. What I've come away from it thinking, you know, we don't know what the new normal will be, but actually for NHS or health and care services, it's about that partnership working, definitely.
You hear a lot in medicine about kind of blocks in place and certain either departments or specialties or primary care and secondary care not getting along or putting blocks in each other's way. And I think that it certainly reaffirmed to me that we're all in this for the same purpose. We all want the same thing and just talk to each other, and just really inspired me to just kind of push on with trying to develop services and work with secondary care and different specialties just to get the greatest outcome for patients and the NHS as a whole, really. Also made me pick up a bit of research stuff that I'd done in the past, because it really, the outcomes that we saw from the unit were so good and we got on so well, and the way that COVID's gone on since, it's just really relit a fire in me for sure to look at myself and medicine as a whole, really.
And I think a lot of the learning about making quick decisions, that's still in place now, so that we're into surge three on Wirral. We've still got those command structures in place. We've still got groups in place so we can make decisions quickly and log them, because that was the thing that we learned, that you log all your decisions so that it's clear, you know, what decisions you made and when. So I think we have retained some of that, you know, rapid response that is needed, because clearly the situation even now changes. I think I'm more tired than I was when our guests from Wuhan arrived, because as you say, it's nearly 12 months without much let up for any of us, because obviously the Northwest has been particularly affected by COVID and the numbers within the Northwest. But James's point, absolutely support those relationships that we've built through this. I think they will persist, and I think that's a good thing.
And I met some amazing people as well, made some great connections. That's another thing. I would approach anyone that I work with in the unit, which is actually really far reaching within the Wirral community. You know, as we've mentioned, so many different organisations, and I feel that I could happily speak to any of those people again about any non-COVID related thing. And that's really inspiring as well.
Actually, the other thing with it is that we've got a vaccine as well. So in 12 months, not only have we started off with an isolation unit and gone through a full pandemic, still in a pandemic, we've vaccinated in the country, or in the UK, over 4 million people. I mean, it's absolutely outstanding, isn't it? The efforts that all organisations, stakeholders have played in this has been outstanding. And it's been such a, I suppose, a humbling experience of working in the NHS and being involved in this.
And that was a really nice thing. That was another first for us. So we were the first to have the isolation facility, the first to deal with anybody with COVID. And we were in the first tranche of the 50 hospital hubs to get the vaccine. So there's a nice sort of symmetry there, isn't there? So we were exposed to it first, but among the first to get the solution. So that's been brilliant. And again, that partnership working, because obviously the vaccines are given in both in primary care and the hospital hubs. And, you know, that constant dialogue of who we need to focus on next, it has really helped. That's our glimmer of hope, the vaccine.
It is nice to be talking about this when we have got that glimmer of hope, isn't it? And who would have thought we'd have a vaccine being rolled out now if we put ourselves back a year? It's amazing. I just finally want to ask you for some words to describe your feelings about what you've been through. And, you know, you can include the year as well. But that experience that you went through, which was so memorable for you, it was a first for you, it was a first for the country. When you're looking back on it, what words occur to you to describe your feelings?
I was very proud. I think very proud of my colleagues and the whole setup and how we performed. I think the fact that we're all sat here now talking about it means we're obviously all proud to have been involved to an extent, or to a massive extent.
Yeah, I would reiterate that immense pride. It's been really humbling, as I keep saying. There was a real excitement, and although feeling tired like others, it has renewed energy and my sort of optimism with health services and the future sort of changing landscape.
From my point of view, I wish that we hadn't gone through it, that we hadn't all had the year that we've had. That obviously started at the Arrow Park facility for us. I think there have been some positives that have come out of that. You know, as Mike said, from a professional point of view, sort of renewed passion, if you like, for sort of, you know, sort of public health and sort of, you know, communicable disease control thing. I've met some fantastic people. I've had some, you know, some great working relationships starting at Arrow Park, going all through the year. And I just hope that in a year's time, we're sat here and this is just all a distant memory rather than just being in the middle of it as we are at the moment, really.
Yeah, I think my words would be challenging, but also, as Jane, pride that we, you know, have risen to the challenge for the initial thing with the isolation, and then latterly with the COVID pandemic and, you know, administering the vaccine. And I think gratitude is one, you know, it feels lots of people are despondent and tired now, but I do feel gratitude for the people that I work with. I'm grateful that, as I say, everybody left the facility with a clean bill of health. Grateful that community have supported not only with the guests, but with the pandemic. And, you know, we hear lots on media about how people aren't supporting it and how, you know, people are flouting rules, but the vast majority of people are at considerable, you know, sacrifice to themselves. Hopefully for all, this is a period in our working life that we will look back on and say, gosh, that was hard, but we got through it and look what we did. But there are people out there that aren't so lucky. And so that's why I also feel grateful.
And I'm grateful to you all for taking part in this podcast. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating to reflect back with you and hear about your experiences. So thank you for sharing your story. Wendy Shepherd, Mike Gibbs, Dr. James Perry, Dr. Nikki Stevenson, thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
How fascinating. Thanks again to our guests for giving us an insight into an extraordinary experience. If you'd like to find out more about the Arrow Park Quarantine Unit, there are links on our podcast page to more resources. Thank you for listening.